Thank you, everyone, for attending session 202, titled Paul's Wisdom for Our Religious Conflicts. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones be turned off, and those who are attending, be respectful and attentive, and only throw vegetables at Frances. She says the turnips hurt, so stick with the softer ones, like tomatoes. I'm just trying to help you out. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. So like on Saturday, you can go and get a flash drive full of all the sessions that you missed, and they're like $2 a piece. And then you can listen to it in your car or wherever, load it onto your computer. Just one more service we provide here at Sunstone. And don't forget to go buy lots of books and stuff from our excellent vendors, including the cheesecake. I tried the cheesecake. I had two yesterday. They were excellent. This session is 30 minutes long, and we ask that you stay within that time, Francis. St. Paul's missionary years were not easy. There was trouble among the followers of the way in Corinth, squabbling, backbiting, and playing holier than thou. In his first letters to the Corinthians, Paul examines some critical questions in a way that can help us modern-day followers navigate the daunting theological and social issues facing the contemporary church. Frances Menlove has a PhD and an MDiv. She was the first manuscripts editor for Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. And I have just reminded Frances that she's going to put her mouth up to the microphone so that everyone can hear. Take it away, Frances.
How's that? Okay? Close?
I can hear you just.
Thank you for coming. Okay, this morning I am going to try and convince you that Paul can be a great help to us in these fierce theological times. There's been a bit of an uproar in the church lately, with prominent excommunications reported in the New York Times, issues around the ordination of women, acceptance and inclusion of gay and lesbian and transgender brothers and sisters, who is in and who is out, with bloggers and podcasts and tweets and Instagrams flying around. Agitation and trouble and unease. And I think Paul has some deep wisdom for us, deep Christian wisdom, wisdom embedded in a very powerful metaphor. So this is my plan. Here's my plan. I'm going to talk a bit about Paul in his time with his pastoral challenges, and then jump all the way to the church today. There may be a bit of a jet lag because I only have a few minutes, and I understand the perils of trying to compare two such disparate times and places, of trying to make 2,000-year-old wisdom seem relevant to our modern ears. I was reminded recently of this difficulty of unlikely comparison when I was asked if I knew how John the Baptist and Winnie the Pooh were alike. How are they the same? Well, John the Baptist and Winnie the Pooh are alike because they both have the same middle name. Paul was an itinerant tent maker, and he traveled extensively throughout the Mediterranean, helping set up new communities of Jesus followers. They weren't yet called Christians. They were followers of the way. The name Christian came later and was originally uttered as an insult, a term of degradation. We're going to look at Paul's first letter in the 1 Corinthians. Scholars tell us that Paul's authentic letters are the earliest witness in the New Testament. Paul's letter to the Corinthians was written maybe in the late 50s, well before the four Gospels. Paul didn't have any Christian scriptures. He knew of no New Testament. Paul is our earliest witness in the New Testament about what the original Jesus communities were like. We know a little about these communities. They were egalitarian. His letters were addressed to the entire gathering, not the leaders. He reminded these fledgling communities of the radical nature of Jesus' message. He reminded them that the three historic divisions among humans, race, class, and gender, were now erased. These divisions are now healed. These distinctions are in the largest society are obliterated. With baptism, there was no longer bond or free, Greek or Jew, male or female. We also know from these letters that these followers didn't always behave as Paul wished. There was trouble in Corinth. There was bickering, name-calling, arguments about who was loyal to whom, about how their gatherings should be run, about eating and not eating meat from sacrifices to pagan gods, about protocol for speaking in tongues, and Paul was not pleased. All this was going on about three centuries before the notion of heresy was invented. The Apostle Paul had some tough times. But Paul's troubles are a kind of blessing to us today. Because of his letters, we know that the first followers were not perfect. We can't idealize those little communities as little Edens. And because of the troubles, we have Paul's counsel on what to do when dissension breaks out and how to think about dissension, how we should behave in community. Granted, now, the specific problems he was dealing with are not the same as the problems today. Every religion is born in a culture to the specific issues, and the specific issues change over time and place. But maybe Paul's pastoral advice and wisdom can help us navigate our troubles. Maybe Paul's struggles can help contemporary Mormonism with its contentions and strife and guarding of its borders, help navigate the dramatic issues facing the church today around the males-only priesthood, gender identity, social media, around who is in and who is out. A cursory glance at history instructs us about the changing nature of urgent problems and about the need to abandon old certainties in the face of compelling new understandings. We know about cultural lag. Think of the vigorous pushback against Galileo when he explained the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. Now we are trying to grasp a universe not with just billions of stars, but billions of galaxies. We are now living through a pushback as science tells us that gender is complex, not just a binary male or female. Science challenges the traditional notions of human identity and behavior. Sometimes what we think is universal and absolute is historically contingent. New scientific understandings produce new moral insights. We cringe at the Christian defense of slavery in colonial times, and the ardent fight against universal suffrage in our grandparents' times. We repudiate the theology that I learned in high school seminary class about why blacks couldn't hold the priesthood and never would. We roll our eyes at Joseph F. Smith's labeling of civil rights as a communist plot and Martin Luther King as a communist dupe. Core Christian values trumped the prohibition against blacks in the priesthood and no intermarriage. Religious leaders aren't the only ones immersed in their culture making pronouncement that we can cringe or smile at a few decades later. Thomas Watson, the chairman of IBM, in 1943 said, quote, "I think there is a world market for maybe five computers." The chairman of and founder of Digital Equipment Corporation said in 1977, quote, "There's no reason anyone would want a computer in their home." Christianity has survived many ways of expressing and practicing faith, and the LDS Church has survived many ways of expressing and practicing faith. The danger is a sublime and dangerous certainty. In short, divisiveness is nothing new. God works through imperfect instruments. We must remember the great danger of canonizing our own culturally contingent history, our own incomplete understanding. Explanations may be time and culture bound. The greatness of the Bible is displayed as we see this critical thinking incorporated right into this text, right into the sacred text. the role of prophets was to critique their culture, the commonly accepted notions of hierarchy. Hebrew prophets were free to love their tradition and criticize it at the same time. Joseph Smith understood the unfinished nature of the gospel. Cultural norms are not eternal truths. Now is the moment I've been building up to. I hope you're ready. This is Paul's pastoral metaphor, written to the community in Corinth in hopes of giving them both spiritual insight and practical guidance, in hopes they would get their act together and start behaving. Now, listen, and I think we can learn it from it. It's 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And I'm reading from a modern translation because I think contemporary language makes it easier for us to really, really hear. Start. Just as the body has many parts, and all of the parts, even though there are many of them, are still parts of one body, so is the body of the anointed. For we were all baptized by the same power of God into one body, whether we were Jews or Greeks, slaves or free. We are all invited to imbibe the same divine power. The body does not consist of only one part, but of many. If the foot were to say, because I'm not a hand, I'm not part of the body, there's no reason to suppose it's not part of the body, is it? If the ear were to say, because I'm not an eye, I'm not part of the body, that's no reason for thinking it isn't part of the body, is it? If the whole body consisted of an eye, how would it hear? If the whole body were an ear, how would it smell anything? But in fact, God has put each of the parts in the body to accomplish what God intended. If everything consisted of one part, there would be no body. It is not possible for the eye to say to the hand, I have no need of you, or for the head to say to the feet, I have no need of you. But in many respects, the parts of the body that seem to be less important are the most necessary, and the parts of the body that we think are undignified, we treat with more respect. And we clothe our private parts with greater degree of propriety than our most presentable parts require. But God unified the body by giving the inferior parts the greater value so that there would be no division in the body, but the parts would take care of each other. If one part is in pain, all parts suffer. If one part is honored, all parts celebrate. Unquote. Can you hear that last? If one part is in pain, all parts suffer. If one part is honored, all parts celebrate. Recently, Ireland legalized gay marriage in a national referendum. This is what an Irish newspaper said about the vote. See if you can hear, as I read this little quote, see if you can hear the echo of Paul's metaphor of Paul in this little news clip. Remember, if one part is in pain, all parts suffer. Okay, here's the quote. Let's be clear why the Yes campaign won this victory. This is in Ireland. It was about the stories. The Irish are a storytelling people, and gay marriage supporters brought us heart-wrenching narratives of exclusion, fear, loneliness, and unhappiness. We hear from mothers anguished for their gay children and children pleading for recognition for their gay parents. By talking and listening to each other, we have come together to sweep away a long-standing injustice. Unquote. Can you hear Paul's echo in that little clip from the Irish newspaper? We know Mormons are storytellers too, right? We tell stories. And we hear these same painful stories. If one part is in pain, all parts suffer. We hear stories of the obliterating pain that comes from being told, you are not all right the way you are, the way you were born. An intolerance which leads to broken lives, lives lived out in fear and secret, families sundered, and even suicide. We know about the suicides here. We could listen to him, Paul, and embrace our LGBT people and make them full members of the human family and of our congregations. It's a matter of justice. It's a matter of dignity and respect. Paul reminds us that all we have to be is part of the body, that we need the grace from others, and they need it too. This is a unity that celebrates diversity and differences, a unity based on mutual concern. It is because of the differences in the parts of the body that they need each other. There will be differences, but love for the community is stronger than the differences. Paul preached a gospel that breaks down barriers and welcomes the outsider. Jesus apparently didn't know that the function of religion was to define insiders and outsiders. Jesus indiscriminately opened the door to sinners, lepers, tax collectors, prostitutes, women, and children. For Jesus, there were no insiders and outsiders. Jesus preached a boundary-breaking fellowship with love of stranger and prayer for the enemy. He did, however, get a little testy sometime with the religious leaders of his day. I can see his look. Paul shows us that the earliest followers faced divisive issues and how they struggled to move forward together. Can we remember our amazing capacity to be wrong? Can Paul help us widen the tent? Can we create space for critical questions to be examined and remember that God does not need to be defended against knowledge arising out of any source? Any source. Can we remember that a founding belief was that the church encompasses all truth? All truth. Differences can exist without collapsing community. The tragedy now is that in Jesus' name, many people are being told they are out, excommunicated. Jesus didn't reject. He ate with the oppressors and the oppressed alike. Now, I'm going to end, so you'll be happy.
Not 15 minutes.
No, I'm going to end. Okay. I'm going to end with a story. And then after the story, a one-liner for you to memorize and take with you. Okay? Now, first the story. Okay. During World War II, there was a battle in the rural countryside in France. An American soldier was killed. And his armory buddies didn't want to leave him on his body on the battlefield. They remembered a church way back next to a small cemetery surrounded by a white fence. They carried their dead comrade there. They told the priest at the gate their story and asked if they could bury him in the cemetery. "We would like to give him a church burial," one said. "I'm sorry," replied the priest, "but only baptized members of our faith can be buried in this holy ground." As the dejected soldiers turned around and started to walk away, the priest called after them. But, he said, "there's a flat place outside the fence in the field there that's suitable for burial. I'll show you. You can bury your comrade out there." So the weary soldiers dug the grave, buried their friend outside the fence, said a brief prayer. Then they hurried back to their unit. A few days later, they learned their unit was moving on, so they decided to return to the graveside to say a final goodbye to their friend and comrade. They got back, and they searched the area in back of the fence. They looked around everywhere, and they couldn't find it. They couldn't find where they had buried their comrade. Both puzzled and alarmed, they spotted the priest near the church and hurried over to him. They explained they were confused and maybe even disoriented, but they couldn't find the burial site. The priest smiled. "I'll show you," he said, and took them to a gravesite inside the fence. "Did you dig up the grave and move it?" the puzzled soldiers asked. "No," said the priest. "We moved the fence." Now, here is the final one-liner from Paul, a thought for us to leave with. "And now, faith, hope, and love abide. These three, and the greatest of these is love. And now, faith, hope, and love abide. These three, and the greatest of these is love." Thank you.
Kickoff, Francis. Thank you very much. And as you look at our program, you'll see that we have actually a lot of sessions coming up about the other parts of the body, if we might extend the metaphor a little bit. We have the bisexual Mormon mind coming up, living as a Mormon with autism, and I guess that's what I saw. So the next session starts in 20 minutes. Have some fun. What's that? Oh, it's true. If you want to read like 300 pages of this kind of stuff, go to Benchmark and grab one of Francis's books.